My privilege to introduce our third session today entitled Technology in Water and Agriculture, and it will be chaired by Susan Mercon, who is a senior lecturer at MIT's Civil and Environmental Engineering Department. I heard Susan speak for the first time when she was kind enough to come to CSIS maybe 3-4 years ago. And we all were remarkably impressed by, first of all, the scope, her command in terms of the full range of technologies now, and beyond that, the work that she was doing, working with her students across the world in terms of defining low-cost approaches to dealing with water and sanitation issues. As her bio suggests, she has been across the world with these kinds of student groups. The list goes on, Nepal, Haiti, Nicaragua, Dominican Republic, Brazil, Peru, Kenya, Ghana, Bangladesh, and Cambodia. So it gives me great pleasure to welcome her as the chair of this panel entitled Technology in Water and Agriculture.
MIT is a technology school, but not an ag school, and so I'm a funny person to be chairing this panel. However, it happens that the speakers for this panel also aren't necessarily so strong on technology and agriculture either. But fortunately, we did address technology and agriculture quite thoroughly in some of the earlier sessions, and that gives us the opportunity to go a little bit more broad in our speakers' presentations and the themes that we discussed in this, our last session. So with that, I'm happy to introduce three marvelous speakers in this session. Greg Allgood is someone whom I've known for quite a long time through the World Health Organization-hosted International Network to Promote Household Drinking Water Treatment and Safe Storage. Greg has been widely recognized for his work and his product, or the product that he promotes, as director of the Children's Safe Water Program. Is that correct? The product is called Pure, is one that has also received numerous awards and recognitions. And so he will be speaking to us on that product, Pure. The second speaker is Krista. Krista, where are you? Raise your hand. Okay, I look forward to meeting you and hearing you. Krista is she is the director of the hydrologic branch at the Goddard Space Center, and her area of research is the measurement of water and energy fluxes via field experiments and remote sensing, and it is also understanding, and I love this, the space-time structure of precipitation, evapotranspiration, and moisture. So we need to know about that for the topic at hand, the agriculture and technologies. And our final speaker is Juan Jose Conjego, and he is with an NGO that he founded in Oaxaca, which focuses on bringing participation of the people that he works with into a dialogue on nature and society, where really his organization is there to help to bring water and ecological awareness to their enterprises. So with that, I would like to invite the first speaker, Greg, to come up. And all three of our speakers have PowerPoint presentations to present. Thank you.
Thank you, Susan. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks to the organizer. Eric, good to see you again, and thank you for inviting me. So let me pull up my first presentation. There it is. Little guy go away? Great. Thanks. As Susan mentioned, I'll talk about P&G's Children's Safe Drinking Water Program It's a not-for-profit effort that I founded and lead at Procter & Gamble. And it focuses on an example of a technology that we're using to reach the poor-income consumers in the developing world. It's an example that I hope will be useful for perhaps other companies or other partnerships that are forming. It addresses a key public health issue, and that's the fact that more children die from diarrhea than die from HIV/AIDS and malaria and tuberculosis combined. So it's one of our biggest public health issues. And I should say at the start that clearly not any one technology, or in fact not any one approach, can address such a big issue. So we need a variety of approaches and a variety of technologies. One such approach, Susan mentioned, and that is to treat water at the point of use, whether it's the house or the school or the clinic, but right before it's used. And we know that if we do that, then we can dramatically improve the water quality, and in fact, we can save lives. And that's what now the World Health Organization and UNICEF are stating, that household water treatment can save a huge number of lives. Susan and I are proud to be chair people in different working groups in this international network to promote household water treatment and safe storage. And you can see the website there if you want to learn more about it, or of course you can corner Susan or I and ask more about it. Now, Procter & Gamble's involvement in household water treatment goes back to 1995. And we started working with the CDC in Guatemala, and we found that the bleach that we were providing, that's a proven technology for disinfecting water, was very useful to some people. But when we went into people's homes, like this woman in Guatemala, she told us that she didn't trust that that particular product was working because their water was still dirty after she treated it. And we know that if the water has a lot of things in it that use up the chlorine, like organics, that, in fact, not all the bugs will be killed. So we faced two challenges as developers. And at the end of the day, what we did was develop a new product. And I brought my dirty water. You see, hopefully you can see it. We developed this product called Pure Purify of Water. You add it to 2.5 gallons of water, so I'm going to not add all of it. Thank you, that's really good. I didn't add all of it, just added a portion of it. And then you stir for 5 minutes, during which time it clarifies. You let it settle, and you pour it through a cloth, and you wait 20 minutes for the water to fully disinfect. So I'll drink it during the panel, but we'll treat it during the talk. Pure essentially reverse engineers a municipal water treatment plant. And in fact, that's a great idea. Of course, people in the developing world deserve access to the same high quality of water. Could you leave lights up? Deserve access to the same high quality water that we have. And this is a way to quickly get them that while the investment in infrastructure and pipe treated waters continue to be made. It uses as the most active ingredients a chlorine disinfectant, calcium hypochlorite, and it uses a flocculant, iron sulfate, that our municipal water treatment plants use. And as you can see, it can treat even really dirty water to make it clear. All of these water sources are current drinking water sources. So when I first saw water sources like this, I wondered how in the world could people drink water that looks like the one on your far left? Of course, the answer is because that's all they have. So each of these was treated with 1 packet to 10 liters and results in the water that you see on your far right-hand side. And important, not only clear, but microbiologically safe. In fact, Pure actually works in 3 different ways. It kills, it removes, and it leaves some chlorine residual. So even if your buckets aren't perfectly clean or sterile and your cloth isn't, it has some chlorine that kills the germs. It kills the bacteria and viruses in the water, those that cause hepatitis and that cause cholera, very, very effective, as you can see on the slide. And it also removes the chlorine-resistant parasites like Giardia and Cryptosporidium. Because it uses an iron sulfate, it chelates out some of the pollutants in the water. It's very effective at taking out arsenic. And the EPA just recently approved a claim in the U.S., because we also happen to provide the product here, but they reaffirmed the data that we had that shows that it removes greater than 98% of arsenic. And, of course, that's a huge problem in some parts of the world. Now, more important than showing what it did in the laboratory was to do the randomized controlled trials in the field to see if it reduced diarrheal illness. Either the CDC or Johns Hopkins School of Public Health were the principal investigators in 5 randomized controlled trials looking at diarrheal illness and also a trial looking at arsenic reduction. And we saw a very large reduction in diarrhea, a 50% reduction overall. And the studies were done in a variety of settings, up to a year in length, all published in the peer-reviewed literature and showed that it has a dramatic reduction in diarrheal illness. Now we've stirred long enough where we ought to be able to see the coagulation and flocculation process. So when you stir, particles start to come together and fall out of a solution because of the chelation with the iron sulfate. Now, once we had this data, P&G had a decision to make. And one of the decisions that the key decision that we made was to continue the effort as a not-for-profit effort. We at first tried providing it as a commercial effort, but P&G's investment resulted in a negative return on investment. So instead of stopping, like we would for most test markets, we decided to continue as a not-for-profit effort. Now, as you can see, it starts to coagulate and flocculate. And again, remember that one of our key challenges was to provide a product that gave a visual signal that it was working so that people in far remote villages, even perhaps without a formal education, could understand that it's working. And people typically understand that it's working because they say they can see it with their own eyes. Now, when we decided to continue it as a not-for-profit effort, we decided to provide it in two ways. One was for emergency relief that I'll talk about now, and then a minute I'll talk about our other approach, which is sustained social marketing. For emergency relief, like with our health intervention trials and our laboratory data, we used a careful approach at documenting the impact of the product. We worked with Johns Hopkins University, CARE, CDC, and found that it was practical, it was well accepted for emergencies, and also that it had a reduction in diarrheal illness. In a refugee camp in Liberia, for example, Johns Hopkins measured a 90% reduction in diarrheal illness amongst those particularly vulnerable people. It was about the time that we had that data coming in that the Southeast Asia tsunami struck. And within a 24-hour period, we had requests for four times as much product as we'd provided in our commercial test markets over 3 years. So that was a pretty good indication there was going to be a role for the product for providing water during emergency situations. And since then, in the 5 years since the tsunami, for most of the major disasters where there's been a need for water for the survivors of the disaster, we've worked with our relief partners to provide Pure. Including the current cholera crisis in Zimbabwe. We'd worked with both PSI and World Vision. Earlier this year, for the Myanmar disaster, the cyclone Narvis that hit, we worked with World Vision. The floods in Haiti, we worked with Partners in Health, the Clinton Global Initiative, and PSI. So most of the disasters you hear about in the news, those are the ones that we're able to respond to. And we've provided over 60 million of the packets in response to emergency relief efforts. Now, another interesting approach is to provide it on a sustained basis for through social marketing, using commercial marketing techniques, but for usually a subsidized cost or with an impact of measuring a health impact. We do that with a variety of partners, but PSI, who's also the largest social marketer of condoms and bed nets treated with insecticide to prevent malaria, we're working with them in a dozen countries now and some other groups. They get it into commercial distribution, and then work with a variety of groups on the ground to ensure a habit change, which is tough for a health prevention product. We've learned a lot in the last few years, and we're still learning about this. But, for example, we've learned that we need to not only provide it in the commercial market, but also reach those that are most vulnerable. For example, severely malnourished children or people with HIV/AIDS that really need safe drinking water. We have special efforts for. And we've learned that some of the most effective ways to create habit change are working through clinics and schools. You know, when a mother has invested time to walk to a clinic, maybe for hours, she's thinking about health to get her baby immunized or a well baby visit. And when we provide a demonstration of Pure, she learns something that's useful for her family. And that's a way that we've achieved very high sales of Pure through social marketing in countries like Congo. I mentioned schools, but before I do that, it's time to filter. No, thank you. I'd be out of a job, Eric. So the cloth isn't anything special. In fact, this one's very non-special because it's been around the world one too many times with me. A cotton cloth that doesn't have holes. So in a few minutes, starting from very contaminated water, and this water was contaminated, I assure you, you end up with some crystal clear water. And then we'll wait a few minutes. And Susan and I and Eric will drink. I mentioned school programs. An example of the school program is the work we're doing in Malawi with PSI and World Vision. And women's groups sold Pure in the communities for income generation, and we provide it for free in the schools. And we were able to, World Vision, because they run the clinics and the schools of the local community, had good baseline data, and they looked at after intervention with Pure. And they found that both diarrhea in the community and school absenteeism were decreased by more than one half. So a dramatic health improvement and improvement in school attendance, which is critical for breaking the poverty cycle. And importantly, from a programmatic standpoint, they found that provision of Pure was synergistic with their efforts to mobilize the community to build latrines in the schools. And we've not only seen this in the program with World Vision, but we've now seen it in Malawi, but we've also seen it in Uganda with AfriCare and in Congo with the International Medical Corps. And the reason that the groups are telling me that they think it's synergistic is because people can see this working. They can trust it quickly. And the efforts to build latrines or teach hand-washing techniques may take a little bit more trust. And they're seeing that together they're synergistic, which is fantastic because all of these three, hand-washing, sanitation, improved water quality and quantity, are necessary for seeing long-term decreases in diarrheal illness. Now, finally, we've seen that providing safe drinking water to people living with AIDS is very critical. And we didn't anticipate this at first. We didn't know about it, but instead, we saw people coming to us, women in sub-Saharan Africa, like in this picture is Jemima Odo, and she told us that Pure was having a dramatic change in her quality of life. She actually said, Pure's saved my life. She was down to 70 pounds because she had sewage-contaminated water, and she has HIV/AIDS, and her immune system is suffering, so she's not able to keep weight. But when she started using Pure, she was able to regain weight. And now the CDC and other groups have done work to show that, in fact, safe drinking water is critical for people living with AIDS. And now tens of thousands of people every day are getting safe drinking water treated with Pure. Sometimes it's supported by PEPFAR in Nigeria, Cote d'Ivoire, and Ethiopia, and sometimes it's supported by Procter & Gamble, and we're looking for more partners. We have a dozen now that are providing that. And I've never seen more passionate beneficiaries than the people that have AIDS and receive safe drinking water, because before they had a severe and persistent diarrhea, and it goes away after they use Pure. So we're going to do more in this effort. Now, globally, in the last 5 years, since it's been a not-for-profit effort, we've been able to provide 130 million of the packets. And we know where it goes by working with our partners. So we use WHO burden of disease data to estimate the impact on morbidity and mortality. So we can estimate that we've prevented, through this effort, 55 million days of diarrhea and saved more than 7,300 lives. They wouldn't have been saved if we didn't have this program, so it's a good effort to start. Of course, there's a lot more children dying every day than we're impacting, so we want to do more. We want to increase our partnerships. We've committed to provide at least 3.5 billion liters of safe drinking water by 2012, and we hope to do even more than that, so that in the future there won't be children that are dying needlessly from diarrheal illness. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Krista Peters-Ladard, and as you heard, I'm the head of the hydrology branch at Goddard Space Flight Center. I would like to acknowledge a number of my contributors, both in my branch and at other branches at Goddard, John Bolton, Molly Brown, their names are here, Matt Rodell, Dave Toll, and especially collaborators Chris Funk and Jim Verdon from the USGS. I have a few websites here, and I'm sure later on you'll be able to access these PowerPoints and refer to them later, but I'm excited to tell you about things that we're doing, switching from the local scale to the global scale, and that is satellite-based assessment of water resources and agricultural productivity. But one of the first things you might be asking yourself is, why is someone from NASA studying water on Earth? Shouldn't they be studying water on Mars or looking for water in extrasolar planets? Well, it turns out that NASA has a large Earth Sciences program, and we work with other agencies to develop new technologies in satellite remote sensing and apply them to Earth science as well as applications. So, water, agriculture, and NASA. Well, is it rocket science? Actually, I'm going to show you that our technologies can significantly enhance the assessment of water stress and agricultural productivity. I'm going to show you three examples of the types of work we do in water availability assessment, water use, and crop health, and then talk about some future directions. So, the first thing is, we have a lot of assets that have been developed over the last 30 years at NASA to understand and predict the water and energy cycles. And this is a large chart with lots of acronyms. You know, we love acronyms at NASA. But the ones that I'm going to talk about a little bit later are, you know, some of the satellites are really neat. This GRACE, it's a gravity measurement satellite, and it helps measure groundwater. We've heard a lot about groundwater today, and I think you're going to be excited about what we can do today from GRACE. TRIM and GPM, these are precipitation missions. We have different satellites to measure snow. We measure land cover, vegetation health, and so on. And we have our long history of the Landsat program, which measures very detailed 30-meter scale assessments of greenness over the globe. So these are amazing technologies for remote assessment of water and agriculture. So if we look at the first area, water supply, this is the nearest and dearest to my heart as a hydrologist. And that's why I put up a picture of the water cycle, because this really gets at what are the pieces of the water supply that you need to know about if you're trying to understand the connection between water and agriculture. So precipitation, lakes, soil moisture, snowpack, and groundwater. These are the sources of water for agriculture. And so knowing the state of any one of those at any given time is important for understanding how stressed or how much surplus we might have for agricultural purposes. So in the precipitation area, I mentioned we have currently a mission known as the Tropical Rainfall Measurement Mission, TREM. And in the future, we're going to have the Global Precipitation Measurement Mission. And the idea is that you have at least one satellite as part of a constellation of satellites. And one of those satellites is really good at measuring precipitation, and then all the other ones kind of get calibrated or adjusted to match the results of the one that you really trust. And that's the network that we're going to have, especially in 2013. But even now we have that. And so the things that we can measure from space now in Africa, for example, we can measure the onset of the rains. And that, of course, goes into forecasting the yields. We can actually look at our record of precipitation and understand trends. And this is an example from central eastern Kenya by my colleague Chris Funk. And in this case, he's showing that the long rains have had significant decreases over the past three decades that he analyzed, whereas the short rain period, which is sort of the fall season, has had an increase. So looking at how that changing climate, which is another topic that we've heard about today, understanding those trends is also important for assessing uncertainty in the agricultural productivity of any given region. Another area, sort of a water resource area, is lakes and reservoirs. We now have satellites. This is JASON-1 and a new satellite known as NVSAT, which monitor lakes in real time, and there's a website at the bottom. This is funded by the FAS, and it's conducted right at Goddard. And there's a real-time reservoir monitor, so the height of the reservoirs in the lakes is monitored from space. And then that's used in the FAS's assessment protocols each month. And an example of three different ones here shows an interesting trend, which, you know, we could analyze the trends, but the bottom line here is you've got the satellite-based estimate and some validation, and it looks really good. But I think you're seeing, like over here, the RLC, you can see this significant decrease over time from 93 to 2000 to the present, basically. Another example, soil moisture, right? Soil moisture has a big impact on crop stress. We actually work with the USDA FAS again in this work, and also with the ARS part of USDA. And in this one, we actually integrate soil moisture from a satellite. So this is a satellite known as AQUA, and there's a sensor on that known as AMSR-E. And if anyone has questions, I can tell you all about it. But the bottom line is we can measure soil moisture for a really thin layer, and then we can bring it into the model. And you get a very different picture of what the real soil moisture is compared to what you would get using standard techniques. And the reason for that is that you get more spatial detail. You know from the satellite how much soil moisture there is, and you can adjust what you had from the model, which is based on some assumptions that are not taking into account all the current information. Snow. Snowpack is another important source of water. It's also important for other reasons, and in this case, in Afghanistan, you have an example of our sensor MODIS, which is on two of our satellites. This is snow cover extent. So this, the white part is where it's snow covered, and the gray and the orange, it's not. And if you look at, this is 2006, okay, this is just an 8-day period in 2006. It's a January 9th through the 16th, so it's just an example. If you compare that to the previous year, let me flip that. You see how, flip back, flip. Obviously, snow cover varies from year to year. You know that. But what's important for agriculture is to take that snow cover and put it into a model and actually look at the snow water equivalent. So you know how much snowpack, how much storage is sitting there in the mountains ready for supply in the melt season. Groundwater. This is the GRACE instrument I mentioned. We have a really neat opportunity with this because our signal is from the noise from the geodesists. GRACE was launched to map the Earth's gravitational field. That was the purpose. But we figured out that there's this noise in there, which is our signal, and that is that water, the groundwater and the soil moisture changes, affect the gravity. And so by backing out that part of the signal, we can assess the entire total water storage change on a month-to-month basis. And when you combine that with a model, you get a picture. And the yellow dots are what you get from GRACE. And what are shown here are the pieces of all the water stored in from the ground to some level, from the surface to some level in the ground over time. And so you see it starts in January 03 and it goes to 06. To summer of 06. So you can see there's yearly variations, but what's really amazing is that the white here is the snowpack part, the brown is the soil moisture part, this blue is the groundwater part, and this blue line is independent well data. This well data is not used at all in this analysis, so it's an independent evaluation of the light blue. And what's exciting is that for the first time, we now have the capability of monitoring groundwater levels from space. And from what I'm hearing from the previous speakers, that may become extremely important for transboundary water resource assessments. Okay, that's enough for the water supply part. Now let's look at some water use assessments that we do with our technologies at NASA. Irrigation being an important one, and although most of the world is rain-fed, I think irrigation will be growing. We've heard about some low-cost irrigation technologies. Evapotranspiration is the use of, especially the transpiration, is the use of water by the plants. And it turns out that we have now developed a new technique using an instrument known as MODIS to detect where irrigation is occurring. By knowing something about how green the plant is and something about the temperature, you can actually detect from space where irrigation is happening. And this is huge because over most of the world, if it's irrigated, you don't necessarily know where it is. And so once you know that, you can combine that with a model, and you can show how much evaporation changes. And then you can even do things like show how the temperature changes. So if you're interested in surface temperature forecasts, this is big for the energy sector, right? The irrigation has a huge impact on the temperature because it cools the surface. So this is an example of just by accounting for irrigation, you can get a better temperature forecast in your models. And so this is exciting because we can know how much water is being used as well as the impacts on the temperature and the energy part. So Neat stuff. Okay, the other part of the water use side is the evapotranspiration. So as I showed with that one, and this is another example here, which is even finer scale, take Afghanistan and zoom in, and there's a study area. And in this study area, this is a Landsat image in the middle here, and it shows you the areas that are green, which are greener is sort of heavier, more water, and the lighter greens are less water. And you can actually, from that, look at irrigation and its effect on evapotranspiration, how much water is coming back into the atmosphere. And by comparing year to year, you get some sense of how the water use changes from year to year. And this is from 2000, and this is 2003. And so you can see these areas are quite different. Sorry about that. From year to year. So you get huge water use changes from year to year by the changes in the ET. Okay. And then, you know, again, these are colleagues from the Famine Early Warning Systems Network, Jim Verdon and Chris Funk, basically have integrated all of these things together along with some other assessments related to crop health, and that's the last part of the topic, greenness, and use that in yield forecasting. So the greenness, there's something known as the normalized difference vegetation index. It's a measure of how much green vegetation is there. And so they look at these from space, and they look at anomalies, which are just differences from the normal. Okay? And so if it's red in this example, it's worse vegetation. And if it's greener, it's better vegetation. So the red would be stressed. And so then from that, plus some of the water information, you can get an idea of how the yield's going to be because it's an indicator of stress. And that's what they've done. They have an onset-adjusted NDVI set of curves versus days after the onset of rain, so knowing that onset of rain is important here. And then knowing what the NDVI is at the end correlates quite highly with the PCAD, which is the FAS crop production estimates. Sorry about that. So in this case, what's happened is, depending on how stressed things were at the beginning, plus rainfall in between, they've got a whole host of modeling technologies that integrate all these pieces of information together to end up with yield forecasts. And they have shown that if you can project this 4 months ahead, you get huge advances in terms of famine early warning, and that's important for action. So we're excited to be able to work with them to bring our technologies to the different agencies. We work with USAID, we work with USGS, we work with the Air Force Weather Agency, and all of these groups are very interested in bringing the latest remote sensing and modeling technologies to all of these issues in terms of international security. So to kind of summarize in terms of where we're going, you know, we started out being all about the observations, right? NASA's strength is launching satellites and providing observations to everyone. But through the work we do at the centers, like Goddard Space Flight Center, in modeling and assimilation, which is combining those observations, we can apply these to help decision makers in water and agriculture, as well as other sectors like energy and weather. So kind of to summarize at the last point here, water and agriculture, is it rocket science? Yes. In our case, our earth science satellite sensing and assimilation techniques have advanced our capabilities for monitoring transboundary water resources and agricultural productivity. We're global, and we monitor water availability. I showed you examples, precipitation, lakes and reservoirs, soil moisture, snowpack, groundwater, all the components pretty much now we have a technique for monitoring. Water use, irrigation, evapotranspiration, crop health through the greenness indices, and yield forecasting with our partners at FAS and FuseNet. And then finally, as we move forward, we really would like to see everything integrated into a common modeling and assimilation framework, and that's what we've been working on at Goddard Space Flight Center. So thank you for your attention, and I look forward to the panel.
Good afternoon. Very pleased to be here. And I need to apologize for my English. I'm less stupid in Spanish. Well, slightly. And I have to do it in 15 minutes, so not only I have to seem intelligent, but do it quickly. So let's go to the background. The project I want to present has to do with the Central Valleys in Oaxaca. And if you check, it's the southern Mexico. This is a map of the important regions for conservation, and you can check it's practically the whole state. Remember that Mexico is already a hot spot in conservation, perhaps ranks fourth at world level, and Oaxaca is the first in the country, so it's very rich. More detail, even more detail, and after the NASA presentation, this is not very impressive. This is the city, the Central Valleys harbor, the big city, the capital, Oaxaca City. And as I said, not only Oaxaca has got the highest number of plants and animals in the country, but it also harbors the highest cultural diversity. So we have a very diverse set of ecosystems and of peoples. And we also have mountains, and mountains mean different types of climates and different, very difficult conditions for agriculture. They also mean a lot of communities very sparsely distributed along the territory. And as a result of that, we can have places where it rains less than 1 foot a year, and not so far away places that it, where it rains more than 10 meters a year. So what we have is a lot of contrasts. And contrasts not only include nature, they have to do with the rural conditions compared to urban conditions. So this is the Cuicatlán Valley, and at the left, the cloud forest in the Sierra Juarez. So it's very different. And the differences are not only geographical, they're also seasonal. This is a spot of a tropical dry forest during the dry season and during the wet season. So talking about water, we have very different conditions and very well localized wet season in terms of distribution. And the last thing about the background that I want to mention is that water has long been associated with the kind of sacred places. You will find it all over the state. The attitude towards water among Indian communities and rural communities, even now, it's very important. Unfortunately, these recent trends mean soil erosion, deforestation, land use changes, pollution, modern forms of production, especially the consequences of the so-called Green Revolution package that has affected the traditional agricultural system, destruction of plants and animals. And I mention all this because we really believe that in the root of this water crisis, there is an issue of social attitude. And we really think that we need to go back to the attitude of Indian communities in the sense that they still consider water as something limited, valuable, and dependent upon cosmic conditions. We, and I mean modern society, are a kind of dry society. And in terms of what we need to do, we need to get into water again as society. We need to do that. Water issues mean technical issues, political issues, economical issues, but in the root there is an issue of the social attitude. And a way to present that, and it's very simplified, of course, is to compare traditional perspective and modern perspective related to different issues. For example, what we think of water in the traditional perspective and how do we consider it in modern terms. And I cannot get into a lot of detail, but more and more we have turned water from being something sacred, often a goddess, into a commodity, and even worse, in a way to get rid of wastes. And I think that this is very clear. It is very clear the level of disrespect that we show. I would like to make a remark about two issues that were mentioned before during this meeting. First is the issue of the size. Someone mentioned that we have not necessarily to think of small projects as better projects, but I think we must be very careful in scaling what we do. And of course, an elephant cannot be diminished to the size of a mice, but we cannot either turn a mice into the size of an elephant. But we have to decide how many elephants and how many mice do we require. And there's not enough room for a lot of elephants right now. And I'll get into this perhaps later if I have time. So to get into technology, we work in the Central Valleys. This is a 19th century painting of the Oaxaca Valley, and this is the name of our project. And you can see how the city has grown from 30,000 people in the 1940s. We are now about 700,000. So that means an increased demand. And in the same place, we have this very ancient traditional record, the Milpa, and a very highly organized system of getting water in the past that we are in the process of destroying. In the Central Valleys, it doesn't rain a lot, but it runs down a lot of water from the mountains. And they, in the past, we have used to have very effective methods of channeling water for agriculture. We are in the process of destroying that. So what we devised, the idea behind our project, has to do with the city, and you will perhaps be wondering what does the city has to do with the agriculture and irrigation. And I think it's very important because cities are actively sucking not only water and natural resources, but also money and attention from the field, the surrounding fields, and they are not sustainable. And if we are to solve the crisis, even in the rural realm, we need to build sustainable cities. And in order to do that, there's a number of things we need to do to protect what the remains of the natural spongs that catch rainwater. We need to restore the pipe systems of the cities. We need to catch rainwater again, something that we lost along the way. We need to improve agricultural watering, of course. We need to save, to ration, and to reuse water. We need to establish fair fees for water services, but also compensations for those usually rural communities that actively protect natural resources. And finally, we need to get water back to nature in a decent way, something that we don't do right now. We have a lot of problems, but still the size of the city and the traditions of its inhabitants make us think that we can attain a sustainable city. So the principles we are using for this project, as I mentioned, we need to change the way we conceive water, the social relationship towards water. We need to do it in a holistic way, at least at the level of the watershed, but at the same time, we need to act locally. We have to do it respecting local autonomy, and also we need to do it in a collaboration mood. And that means that we need to work along different lines at the same time. We need basic research of the watershed to know a kind of photograph of what is happening. We need a table that means the collaboration process in which all of the actors are seated at, the good, the ugly, and the good ones. We need a plan. We need certain concrete tools, technology. And we need a process of dissemination, environmental education that goes along with the rest of the lines. And now we'll concentrate on the tools. Finally got to technology, as offered in this panel. And we work in a number of different tools, full savings tools, and this has to do with agriculture and water because it prevents cutting down more wood for house use, dry toilets, systems to treat water at the house level, solar stoves and so, and also different types of irrigation. These are some of the concrete techniques that we are using. We also have a demonstration center. We call it a permaculture demonstration center. These image is typical of what is happening around the city. We have the forest at the left and the city at the right, and in the middle, a system of creeks that we urgently need to protect because these are key for the water local cycle. So what we're doing here we have a rainwater catching bowl, a system of small dams, terraces. This is the water rainwater catching bowl. This is one of the small dams. These are the barriers to protect soil from soil erosion. This is the system we follow. It's the same old system, but in contour and combined with the fruiting trees, for example, is the old milpa improved. A plant nursery, dry sanitation systems, a greenhouse inside, reforestation in general. In a specific terms, we work with different techniques, drip irrigation especially. And recently, we got into building greenhouses in a combination of local raw materials with plastic, which makes these greenhouses dramatically lower in price, 4 times less than a conventional greenhouse. Some images of this. We also support forestry production with the irrigation. And that's it. Thank you very much.
To come up. We've had a great, can people hear me okay in the back? We've had a great diversity of speakers, and you've heard a lot from the front of the room today. I want to open it up to you all to ask questions and to interact around the excellent set of presentations we've had. So can I ask for questions from the floor? Yeah. Please say your name and your affiliation.
My name's Duncan. I'm with the World Bank. I just wanted to ask the lady from NASA. I'm sorry, I didn't get your name.
Krista.
Krista. My name's... My question to you is the extent to which the NASA technology, which I've seen a few times before, I think a lot of it is really exciting and all over the place to some extent. To what extent is that data going to be available to people in the field in countries other than the United States? Mm-hmm. Because my concern is a very great deal of this is U.S. government-led. A lot of this data is going to be U.S. government used and not available to people that are working on the ground in places where a lot of this data would be useful going forwards. You know, particularly the stuff that you had there on Africa. I've worked a lot in the Nile Basin, and we really do use this data, the rainfall modeling and the precipitation data, on a regular basis. But I'm concerned that some of this stuff is really exciting and would be useful, but may not be available to the people that could use it most in the near term rather than the long term.
Right. Great. Well, thank you for the question. NASA's data is available online all the time, so any of the data sets I mentioned are available. The issue comes when one tries to apply the data to a particular model or decision support system. And so the way we've generally worked is with other agencies, and we've received funding from USAID and others to customize ways to combine our data with your system. And it could be, like, for example, there's a new initiative that started recently with the Arab Water Council. You may be aware of that. It was discussed at the World Water Forum last week. We had a contingent there. And that's to develop an Arab land data assimilation system that is customized and unique to that region. So we do want to work with other agencies to get the data to you faster. Some of the things I showed are cutting-edge science, and they would take that kind of a directed effort to bring them more quickly. But then the general way we transition our work is through our partners, either at NOAA, Air Force Weather Agency, USGS, et cetera. So, you know, you're right that it wouldn't immediately be in your hands unless you wanted to figure out how to use the data yourself, which is, that's really one of the reasons we're here, is to bring that capability to you. So great question. Thanks.
My name is Amy Lin. I'm a SCI student. I was interested in Mr. Allgood's presentation on the Pure product, and especially the component of income generation combining, providing an income generation source for local women to sell that product in communities. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about how that has worked, whether different pricing has to be established for different types of income levels in different communities, and how what kind of volume of packets has really been able to be distributed, especially since there may be resistance from local community to pay for water if they think that they can have it for free.
The last part was the volumes, you said?
Well, I was wondering about both volumes and also social acceptance of the concept of paying for these packets, especially if you're giving it away for free in other circumstances.
Yep. So the way the pricing works is that we make it for about 3.5 pennies per packet. So each packet treats 10 liters. And then has to be imported. That usually costs about half a penny. Sometimes there are duties and tariffs. So typically it takes no more than 5 cents to get it into a country, and then it's sold anywhere from 7 to 13 cents, depending on what the duties are. So you could say an average of about 10 pennies per packet, and each packet treats 10 liters. Places like I mentioned in my presentation, Jemima Odo and her group, Safe Water and AIDS Program in Africa, they've been selling it for 6 years now. And every year, it's one of the top things that they sell by volume. However, I can tell you that in places where we've tried where that's all they sell, it hasn't worked. So they sell other water treatment products like Aquatabs and dilute bleach. They sell bed nets. They sell protein supplements, a number of health products for people living with AIDS. But that market basket of things that they sell, it seems to work pretty well. In places like Congo, we've seen most of the Pure that we've provided in Congo has been sold through PSI and then commercial distributors. In other countries like Ethiopia, most of it's been provided for free, even though the amounts that are also sold there are more than 1 million packets a year. Social marketing is tough. I mean, getting people to change habits and the different things it take to get it accepted are difficult to learn. I mean, even in the U.S., people have had a heart attack. Only 50% of people take their medications prescribed by a physician. So to get someone to do a health prevention habit in the developing world, people live on a dollar a day, is tough. So we're learning things like the school program and clinics. And we're also learning, I'm going to keep learning, we're going to do price subsidy tests and look at what happens comparing free to subsidized product to full cost recovery and see if there's a, you know, an inflection point that you get higher volumes.
Hi, I'm Darcy O'Callaghan from Food and Water Watch. Señor Consejo, thank you very much for your presentation. One of the questions I would like to ask is about how you interact with the local government and if you are looking to replicate your model in other local communities.
Well, as I mentioned, one of the principles is that of collaboration. And we devise that as a kind of a table in which all the actors are seated. The government is an important actor, sometimes for good, sometimes for bad. So we have to have it in the table. And perhaps this is the most difficult part. I mean, it's easy to interact with communities, and we are used to cooperate with other non-governmental groups. But government officers are hard to convince because they have to accept not only to sit at the table in which there are 20 or 50 other actors, but they have to follow what they decide. They used to kind of to treat with kind of advisory councils, but the idea of this project is to that the capacity of the table is also mandatory. I mean, they have to decide what to do. The principle is that we get this photograph, we put it at the table, and then all the actors discuss what should be done about a general issue, such as city growth planning, or about a specific issue, such as fees for different services. So we are using the power of the whole of the members to press government to accept what we are discussing in the table. And we also have the three levels of government. We have the federal government, state government, and local government. And in the case of local government, is I would say it's much easier. They're quite more open to collaborate because they urgently need this kind of support.
Could you give a specific example?
Well, in a way, what this table does is kind of recommendations in the form of human rights commission. So very often what we review is government projects. Nowadays we are struggling against a huge government project to bring water to this watershed from a faraway source. That means a big dam and a channel of 80 kilometers to get the water to the city. We think this is a bad idea, and we are trying to convey with all the actors to discuss this openly. The usual way that the government does this is that it presents the project as something decided. They say it will benefit the population, but in fact most of the process is hidden. So what we are trying to do, and I don't know if we will succeed, is to make this process open to the different sectors. So whatever they propose can be done, provided free conditions, sound projects, an open process, and respecting the law, especially environmental law.
Internet questions. We all live on the internet.
That's right.
All right. So, can you give us the approximate cost to develop the remote sensing satellite system? Krista.
Oh, wow.
And how else can we use that money?
Good question. I can't give you the cost. I mean, all of these systems are based on many decades of research and development. So if you looked at NASA's budget for the last 30 years, and you know, you could pull it out, but I can't off the top of my head. But I think, I mean, each system is developed for the purpose of understanding our planet. And so one of the goals is that we give benefit back to society when we apply these technologies and transition them for decision-making and other beneficial purposes. So, but sorry, I don't know it off the top
okay.
of my head.
And the second part of the question was, given the investment in technology level, developing countries need to benefit from those technologies developed in the United States. How can we achieve knowledge sharing? How can we achieve knowledge sharing and information dissemination? That's similar to the gentleman from the World Bank's question.
Right.
Do you have some specific ideas? You know, for example, Google Earth is a great platform for knowledge sharing.
Right.
How can your data be more widely shared in open source types of way beyond the data itself?
Right. In fact, some of the websites I had on my first slide are ways that we share our modeling technologies. We not only develop the data, all the data is online. You can download it anywhere in the world at any time. But we also share our source code. We share our algorithms. And we work with agencies to bring the data to you. So we know that you've got your own systems, you've got your own needs. And so Our objective is to customize our products and science for your individual needs, and we've done that already with, I mentioned the Air Force Weather Agency. You know, they're working with our code right now. It's going to become operational, or it has become operational. So those are examples where we sort of give back to, and those sorts of things could be repeated by working with us to accelerate getting that, transitioning the technology, I think that's, and the science.
One of the things that I thought was really cool about your this presentation.
Is your microphone?
Okay. One of the things I thought was really cool about your presentation was the work that you're doing on water supply.
Yeah.
And I wondered if there's been any effort to do remote sensing of water pollution, which was not mentioned, but which
it was,
is
right.
Hugely important for agriculture and water, as you know.
Yes. And, you know, we've done a lot of ocean remote sensing, ocean color, looking at basically chlorophyll concentrations. But now we've got some research on remote sensing of turbidity, which could be huge. But it's very coarse scale right now. It's not there yet. But I think it's coming. And so, you know, that's another huge area that I think we will be able to contribute to in the near future. So, you know, I think one of the things that we do is we do make some of our products routinely available. We would love to do more of that. And again, I mean, we're sort of funding limited, but, you know, I think partnering, this is a great place where we could partner with other agencies as well as even the private sector. You know, you mentioned Google. I mean, there's lots of ways we could get our information out better than we can now. And it really would just take some dedicated effort because putting all the pieces together would really, with some dedicated effort, could result in huge advances and could really give you an integrated approach to assessing water and agriculture as well as other sectors like energy.
Okay, go ahead. Okay.
Actually, it's just a quick comment. My name is Christy Tabai. I'm with Save the Children. And this comment will maybe fill in a gap. I just want to talk briefly about a project that's going on in Afghanistan that actually is using some of the data you collected. It's a project that's run through the global livestock CRISP, and it's using the data to actually develop a livestock early warning system. And that project is funded by the USAID. So even though it's not available through Google, that information is specialized. It's taken out in pieces to develop a product in order to accomplish something larger. So maybe that helps a bit more.
Okay, so thank you all, and we'll go now to the last part of our conference today.
Susan, thank you very much for your chair capabilities, both with and without microphone, on that session. They were interesting. Oh, I thought we were going to drink the water. I was going to propose we toast. All right, here's to Pure. Thank you very much, and what an interesting and intriguing, insightful panel. Thank you very much to all three participants.